Hi, it's Robin Young. Thank you for listening to Here and Now. If you love to listen to your favorite shows, hear your favorite stories, and NPR is your personal connection to the world, keep your love for public radio alive. Visit donate.npr.org/now to give, and then tell the world why you're passionate about listening by tweeting or posting on Facebook with hashtag WhyPublicRadio. From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The Republican tax bill is now tax law after President Trump signed it into law today.
I was going to wait for a formal signing sometime in early January, but then I watched the news this morning and they were all saying, will he keep his promise? Will he sign it by Christmas? You are one. But will he sign it by Christmas? And I called downstairs. I said, get it ready. We have to sign it now.
And the president also tweeted this, at some point and for the good of the country, I predict we will start working with the Democrats in a bipartisan fashion. Infrastructure would be a perfect place to start. After having foolishly spent $7 trillion in the Middle East, it is time to start rebuilding our country. Well, plenty to talk about with our Friday Politics Roundtable. Joining us this week, Tolu Olorunapa, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Hi, Tolu.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And Rick Klein, political director for ABC News. Hi, Rick.
Great to be with you.
Well, and great to be with you both. And we want to start with what the president seemed to be referring to in that sound that we heard. This idea that people were saying he wasn't going to sign it. It's been reported that if the president signed the tax cut bill before Christmas 2017, it could trigger automatic spending caps and cuts to programs like Medicare. So there was talk, Rick, if I got this right, of him signing the bill later.
He would much rather be Santa than the Grinch in this season of giving. And yes, if he had signed the bill in 2017 and they hadn't waived these automatic cuts as part of the spending deal that got approved overnight in the Senate, then the possibility was there that he would have had to have a whole bunch of budget cuts. So there was a procedural reason and maybe some good policy reasons. I don't think it's entirely accurate to say that it was only because of the press criticism, but I also think that played a factor in this president's mind for him to get this done before Christmas.
So he yelled downstairs, which is quite an image because I don't think of there being like four steps downstairs from his room. But to be clear, the temporary spending plan that Congress passed to avoid the government shutdown nullified those spending caps, so he could sign, which he did.
Tolu, what about the idea of President Trump working with the Democrats next year? Do you see that happening?
Well, right now, it does not appear that the president has done very much to, you know, extend that olive branch to Democrats. Democrats, even the ones that are up in the Senate next year who are running in states where Trump won their states and probably have some incentive to work with him and at least not be seen as part of the resistance for their own political objectives, they have, for the most part, not felt that the president is reaching out to them. The president has been very polarizing. His approval ratings are very low among Democrats, but also just sort of low across the board. But if he's going to get anything done next year, which is an election year, it's already going to be difficult to get anything done. He's going to have to reach across the aisle. Especially in the Senate, they saw their majority shrink to 51-49, and right. You need 60 votes to do anything major in the Senate. So he's going to have to reach across the aisle, but he hasn't shown really the ability to do that thus far.
Well, you mentioned 51-49. You're talking about the election of Doug Jones, the Democrat in Alabama. And I wonder, Rick, as you look at the last couple of weeks and we see this huge defeat for President Trump and the Republicans when Roy Moore lost in Alabama, but at the same time, this huge victory with tax cuts.
Yeah, and this president understands marketing. And I think winning begets winning in President Trump's mind. And I think that's why he's trumpeting this accomplishment as part of what he says is a historic season of accomplishments. He's calling it already the biggest tax cut in American history. We know that's not the case. He's talking about how Democrats have buyer's remorse. We haven't heard that from Democrats. So much of it is in the marketing. And I thought it was telling today for him to say that I'm actually not going to have to sell it. It's going to sell itself. That is quite the gamble when you realize how unpopular this bill is and the sprawling impact it's going to have across the economy, the healthcare system, the energy sector, and beyond next year.
You know, Rick, I just want to ask you, and Tolu, you can jump in as well. Why do you think this tax cut plan is so unpopular, despite all the language around it from the Republicans that it is going to put more money in the pockets of more Americans? Why?
Because it is the Trump plan. I think it tracks his approval ratings. And if his numbers go up, maybe the suggestions around this. But people are not willing to believe the assurances of Republicans. The party has a very poor name ID approval right now. And the president himself is deeply unpopular. So I think a tax bill associated with him is going to be proportionately unpopular.
Mm-hmm. And one other aspect is people have been watching this process. And at the beginning, this bill was it included a number of provisions that would have hit a number of vulnerable populations. In addition to getting rid of the individual mandate, they were going to get rid of expensing and deductions for people who have really high medical costs. They were going to really increase taxes on graduate students. They were going to take away all of the state and local tax deductions. So they sort of massaged the bill a little bit during the process to make it less impactful in a negative way for a number of people. And I don't think all of that messaging has gotten across in this very rushed process. And people haven't really figured out that a lot of the things that they hated about the bill were stripped out. And then secondly, I mean, one thing that was kept in is the idea that a lot of the benefits of this bill are going to the uber wealthy people,
right,
who are, owning corporations and pass through businesses. And I think the fairness aspect is part of what's factoring into the unpopularity of
this. And it is, as we know, going to add maybe more than $1 trillion to the national debt. And I want to listen to Rand Paul, the Republican senator who voted for this plan, talking yesterday.
Is it any surprise that the debt continues to rise? No, because both parties are responsible for it. Look, I was all for the tax cut. I think it's good for the country. But I'm also for restraining spending.
Rick, what do you make of this? Not just Rand Paul, a lot of Republicans who have been talking about how terrible deficits are for so long, and then they vote for this tax plan, and now they want to cut spending.
Well, it's an obvious point to make that you're for it until you're suddenly – it doesn't seem politically convenient any longer. And I think it's – look, this is an argument that Democrats are going to take back to voters and say that they're being hypocritical about this. I think it gets back to the point about it's being so much easier politically to give than to take. And when you get down to it and you have to get to actual programmatic cuts, it's very difficult. Meanwhile, handing out a big tax cut, I do think it's telling that they waived those budget rules right at the end of the year to try to make this happen. I'm also struck by how many tough choices are going to confront them. It's not just the deficit and the debt, but children's health insurance and the status of the Dreamers. So many of these things are going to come crashing back in the first couple months of 2018.
Well, Tolu, what about social programs? Because I remember weeks ago we were hearing that there was speculation that the Republicans were happy to blow up the debt and the deficit with the tax bill because they are all for rolling back other programs. And there was a lot of analysts saying, no, that's not true. That's not happening. And now you have Paul Ryan talking openly about wanting to next change Medicare and other social programs.
Yes, this is the next big thing on Paul Ryan's agenda. The House Speaker wants to really revolutionize the way that these social programs work and cut them back significantly in order to sort of scale back the size of the national debt. Now, President Trump has said that he campaigned on not wanting to change Medicare and not wanting to roll back Social Security. And it's really a non-starter in the Senate where you do have that very slim majority. No Democrat wants to go into 2018 saying that I cut Social Security or Medicare. So you did hear Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, sort of shy away from this idea that entitlement reform was going to be a big part of the 2018 agenda, even though that's something that Paul Ryan wants. So it doesn't appear that, aside from welfare reform, which may get some sort of movement next year, that major changes to Social Security and Medicare will happen before the midterms.
We had another one of these moments this week where there was a cabinet meeting and the members of the cabinet, including the Vice President Mike Pence, just praised President Trump in a way that you really just you don't see that very often. But let's take a listen.
Thank you for seeing through the course of this year an agenda that truly is restoring this country. You said we could make this economy great again. And you promised to roll back regulations. And you signed more.
And I just, I'm deeply humbled as your vice president to be able to be here. But mostly, Mr. President, I'll end where I began. I want to thank you, Mr. President. I want to thank you for...
It goes on.
3 minutes.
And by the way, that is a montage. That's not exactly how that happened, but it went on for 3 minutes. Rick, what do you make of that?
And it's not just Mike Pence. You heard it from Mitch McConnell. You heard it from Paul Ryan, Orrin Hatch. They talked about his exquisite and incredible presidential leadership. The superlatives, it's like Trumpism has infected the entire Republican Party. They understand how to get through to this president. And I think so much of that messaging is about getting in the president's own ear. He loves hearing those sort of things. He loves those superlatives. He loves the congratulations. And I do think it's telling when you have these moments and people that clashed with him over time, like a Mitch McConnell or a Paul Ryan, are out there talking about how wonderful his leadership is. They're trying to trumpet himself up because they realize that he is a better president from their perspective when he feels better about his leadership.
Well, it could be, too, that they're responding to some of the recent reporting stories today about a heated meeting at the White House on Wednesday of Trump's political team, former Trump campaign manager, now commentator Corey Lewandowski, dressing down the president's political operation and leaders at the Republican National Committee. You've got Trump former chief strategist Steve Bannon speaking to Vanity Fair, saying the president has lost a step.
Yeah, they should be worried about him politically, about his political standing. The midterm year does look grim right now, and there's a lot of dissension in the ranks about how to handle that.
I'm just wondering if they're trying to raise his spirits.
Well, his poll numbers are not going to raise his spirits, so they are trying to make sure that he's happy. And, you know, when the president is angry, we've seen him lash out. We've seen him lash out after Charlottesville. We've seen him take on the Republican establishment and tweet things that really drive the news cycle. So they don't want that kind of divisiveness going into 2018. So if it takes, you know, some over-the-top praising and fawning over the president to keep him sort of in a good mood and not doing anything that's rash and could hurt their political prospects, yeah. I think that's a calculation that they're making.
That's Tolu Olorunipa, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. We've also been speaking with Rick Klein, political director for ABC News. Thanks to both of you. Merry Christmas.
Merry
Happy
Christmas.
Holidays.
Thank you.
NPR's Eric Deggans has described himself as an ornery TV critic on occasion, and today he's wearing that badge proudly to talk about some of his most disappointing TV shows of the year. Hi, Eric.
Hey.
And it's been such a good year for TV. I'm surprised we're talking about this. But, of course, there are some bad ones out there. And on your list, that starts with HBO's The Young Pope. This is with Jude Law and Diane Keaton.
Everyone is afraid of you.
It's not exactly true. But it will be.
What don't you like about it?
Well, this was a show that was a visual feast. It was very well shot and composed, but I felt like the plot wasn't really there. This was a juicy setup. Jude Law was playing the first American to be elected pope. He's also a young man. He's also very much a narcissist. And there were so many possible parallels there between the tension between America and Europe, the tension between American-style Catholicism and the traditions of Catholicism that have generally controlled the Vatican. There was so much there to be explored, and so much of it was wrapped up in the visual look of it and sort of giving you these visual scenes that were very compelling but didn't necessarily connect to a coherent plot. So I had a hard time with this show. And didn't enjoy it very much.
Okay. And another you didn't enjoy is the revival of Twin Peaks on Showtime. What didn't you like about that one?
Yeah. And so now I'm setting myself up to get all kinds of mail from people about all this stuff. So I want to make it plain that we're talking about shows that a lot of people liked and that landed on a lot of people's best of lists, but that I personally had a hard time with. And Twin Peaks is a perfect example. Here's another show that was a great visual feast. But as everyone knows, David Lynch is the kind of director who's very impressionistic and doesn't often give you very much concrete plot to connect, very compelling visual scenes that he presents to you. And in this case, he set up a situation with Showtime, but they just let him do whatever he wanted. And so we have an 18-hour film cut into pieces that at times was so difficult to follow. The experience wasn't pleasurable for me, and I didn't feel like it was a story that I want. It felt like an endurance test. Watching this is what it felt like for me.
Well, and I have to say, one of the nice things about looking at the downside of television in this way right now is that I haven't seen the two shows that you've talked about, so I feel good about that. I feel like I've missed out on things that weren't good. Okay, Eric, the last choice that you have brought us is going to be one where you and I disagree, and that is you put Curb Your Enthusiasm on this list, and I'm a huge fan of Curb. Now, I agree with a lot of the critics, including you, of Curb, that this season was a little over the top sometimes, and it didn't have some of the same ingredients that have made that show so good. But I just want to play you a clip that I have watched over and over again from this season. This woman comes over to Larry's house in the middle of a dinner party. Let's listen.
Hello, I'm Rose Shapiro. Remember me?
No.
I sold you this house 5 years ago.
Oh, okay. What can I do for you?
Well, I was in the neighborhood and I thought I'd just pop in and see how my house is doing, if that's okay with you.
Actually, I'm sorry. I've got some dinner guests, so.
Well, I won't take but a minute. I was so happy in this house. I lived here for 50 years, raised all my children here. Is that okay?
Okay.
Oh,
but
thank you.
It can't be too long, though. Okay,
it won't be. Okay. I promise you, I'll be very discreet. What have you done here? You've covered up that cut stone from Italy with a rug.
Yeah, well, it needed a little warming up in here. It was very cold, and I happen to like it. And you know what? It happens to be my house, so.
So it goes on and on. But there are some funny scenes in this season.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I thought in particular the season ended strong. Lin-Manuel, I thought you were going to play a clip with Lin-Manuel Miranda. He does a great job towards the end of this run of episodes as a great foil to Larry David. But as I said when I reviewed the series when it first came back, the humor of Curb Your Enthusiasm was often the fact that Larry David is this misanthropic guy, and he has these misanthropic kind of reactions to situations, and but the people then react in a way that you can also criticize. And that's the normal rhythm of Curb Your Enthusiasm. But so much of the season was him being misanthropic in a way where the show was sort of saying, he's right, everybody else is wrong. And that was never where the show gelled for me.
Right.
The show gelled when it was him being wrong and other people being wrong and him sort of poking fun at the absurdity of his own reactions and then also poking fun at the absurdity of other people's reactions to his wrongness. That was the juice of the show. And so to come back with a show that takes, you know, 4 or 5 episodes to finally get going, and then the finale is really at the level that I felt the show should have been at when it first started, you know, that was disappointing to me. And it was a significant disappointment. I'm not saying it's the worst show that aired. I am saying that I hope they've been picked up for another season, and I hope they come back at the level that the show stopped this season, because that's what we expect from Larry David.
Eric Deggans, NPR's TV critic. Eric, I'm still a big Curb Your Enthusiasm fan, but I take your points. They're all good points.
I told you I was ornery. anybody who has to watch 200 episodes of television in a year is going to get a little salty.
Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
So, do any of these images ring a bell? A frozen tongue on a metal post. A children's toy that could shoot your eye out. A leg lamp glowing in a living room window. Well, you have to have gotten it by then. These all come back again Sunday night when Turner Broadcasting kicks off its annual Christmas Story Marathon. The popular holiday film was shot more than 30 years ago in Cleveland, and a cottage industry has grown up around it. David C. Barnett from WCPN IdeaStream has this story.
If you don't believe me, I'll double dare you.
The exact 5 kids gather around a lamppost on the stage of the Cleveland Playhouse.
So you're saying if I put my tongue on this post, it'll stick?
Yeah.
That's dumb. It wouldn't happen.
I triple dog dare you.
Oh, sure.
Playhouse artistic director Laura Kepley says this stage version of A Christmas Story is a gift that keeps on giving.
It brings in the most amount of people. Like, this is our most popular show every year.
Although the story is set in Homan, a fictionalized version of writer Gene Shepard's hometown Hammond, Indiana, the movie was shot on the south side of Cleveland. It tells the story of Ralphie Parker and his desperate desire to get a Red Ryder air rifle for Christmas, despite his mother's warning.
BB guns are dangerous. I don't want anybody shooting his eye out.
The film's other iconic prop is a tawdry leg lamp that arrives at the house one day in a big wooden box with a stenciled warning.
Fragile. It must be Italian.
Well, I think that says fragile, honey.
Oh, yeah.
As the movie's popularity grew over the years, San Diego businessman Brian Jones and his family started making and selling leg lamps. Then, one day, he saw a notice that the house here in Cleveland where A Christmas Story was filmed was on the market.
Leg lamps are selling really well, and the house came up for sale on eBay. Why not?
He took out 6 credit cards to pay for a full renovation of the deteriorating structure. It opened as a tourist attraction in 2006.
I opened the place on financial fumes, coasting into it. If it wasn't a hit, we're going to be in trouble.
Jones says the first holiday season, there were 4-hour waits to get into this tiny mustard yellow house on Raleigh Avenue. Attractions include a visit to Ralphie's bedroom, the cabinet beneath the kitchen sink where his brother hid, and of course, a leg lamp in the window. Though the biggest crowds come during December, the Christmas Story house is open all year round.
We've had more attendance every year since, so we had 80,000 people last year. We'll probably have about 100,000 this year.
There's also a Christmas Story gift shop featuring everything from plates and cookie cutters to, you guessed it, leg lamps.
All right, let's put it this way. In the 70s and 80s, the neighborhood was a 9, figure of speech. And as time went on, it decreased. It was 4, 5, and 6, and I'm not making that up.
76-year-old Ted Polanski surveys his changing neighborhood from the window of the 111-year-old Raleigh Inn across the street from the Christmas Story house.
Brian bought from the corner of 11th and Raleigh to 11th and Beer. He got the 3 houses, and 2 of them he knocked down for parking lots, and 1 is a museum.
Polanski grew up here on Cleveland's south side. He owned the Raleigh Inn for 37 years before selling it in 2014. His wife and kid had bit parts in the movie, and they all watched the community decline over the years as people left for the suburbs. Polanski says the Christmas Story house sparked a turnaround.
When Brian took over, he fixed the neighborhood up pretty darn good. It was good for the bar, it was good for the neighborhood, it was good for the city, and they're rolling now. You can see that right now. They're doing great.
So great that Brian Jones was able to snag one of the original Red Ryder air rifles used in the movie for his museum. This $10,000 acquisition is tightly sealed in a special display case. You can't be too careful with an artifact like this because it could, well, you know.
You'll shoot your eye out.
For Here and Now, I'm David C. Barnett in Cleveland.
So what's next for Catalonia? Pro-independence parties came out on top in yesterday's special election, which was called for after the Spanish government struck down October's vote on independence. Now, Spain has autonomous regions. The government collects taxes and distributes them. Many Catalonians feel they pay too much, but enough feel that way for independence. The BBC's Ben James joins us from downtown Barcelona. And Ben, how are you interpreting yesterday's election?
It's very difficult to work out who's won it. That's certainly what the people, the voters that I've been speaking to today, say they were discussing at length as they watched the results come in last night. It's true to say that the parties that are in favour of independence, 3 of them, got the majority if you count their seats together. But it also showed last night that Catalonia is a region divided. It's not so clear-cut that a vast majority of people here want to split from Spain. The largest single party in the result last night is indeed a party that wishes to remain part of the country that it is part of now. I went to their post-election event last night. There were speakers booming. There were DJs on the stage as people were wearing their Spanish flags and dancing in front of that stage. A party called Ciudadanos, Citizens, did very well, much better than before. So it's not necessarily a clear as mm-hmm. as clear a victory for the pro-independence parties as they might like to say, although it's right that they will probably be the parties governing as the government takes shape over the next months.
And what happens to the ex-president of Catalonia, Carles Puigdemont? He fled to Belgium when the last vote, the referendum in October, was declared illegal and his government was disbanded. Does he come back? What happens?
He could well be chosen to be the next president. He's still in Brussels. He's been speaking today. He's been talking about meeting Mariano Rajoy, the Spanish prime minister, but talking about meeting him in Belgium or some other European country. He doesn't want to set foot in Spain because he knows that he's likely to be arrested on those accusations of rebellion and sedition if he does come back here. So big question is whether he can be named president and whether he can do an effective job as president if he doesn't feel like he can actually come here. So it's something we'll have to wait to see how that is managed, how the legal system responds if they do change their opinion at all based on the results yesterday. Something that one of the courts has said in Spain today is that they're actually widening their net when it comes to those charges levelled at political figures after the referendum. Five more of those have been mentioned in that investigation today and have also been accused.
So it sounds like it's, at least for now, something of a draw in Catalonia.
I think that's fair to say. Some kind of draw that will mean the conversation does continue. It's a region that is split. Both sides will claim victory, but also because they're used to having to compromise in a political system where there are seven significant parties in the assembly, they'll have to come to some kind of deal to work together to govern. Something that some are saying is that actually the independence debate is all very well, and it's obvious that people are passionate about it. They do also want the politicians to remember to talk about other things, issues of poverty, of health, of education. Some I speak to in Catalonia feel might be neglected because of all this talk of whether they should be part of Spain or not.
The BBC's Ben James in Barcelona. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It is time now for our annual Christmas edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Joining us is Mike Hale, a.k.a. Mike in the Morning, my favorite childhood DJ. He is general manager at WHMS in Champaign, Illinois. Mike, great to have you back, and Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas to you and all your listeners. Thank you so much. I'm so honored when you asked me to do this. And what's so cool is I hear from people across the country who maybe lived here during college or what have you, haven't been back for 30 years, and they go, oh, he's still there.
Yeah, I know. There's a public radio program director, I think, in Arizona who writes in every year and says, when are you going to air Mike Hale? Because we want to. Well, let's listen to some of the music that you brought us.
Okay.
And this is some new music. You wanted to play something from the group Pentatonix. This is called Hallelujah.
I've heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you? Well, it goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, the major lift, the baffled king composing hallelujah.
Now, I say this is new. It is new comparatively to some of the other music that you have brought us. But how new is this?
This is a couple of years old, okay. And it is from an extraordinary album. And the cool thing about this song is that the four main vocalists of the group take turns on this song doing the lead. And when you combine that to Leonard Cohen writing the song back in the 80s, and I would have loved it to have been just a fly in the room when he sat down and wrote this because he did 80 draft verses of this song. It's just an extraordinary recording.
But it's not a traditional Christmas song.
No, it's it has to do with King David and Bathsheba and Samson and Delilah. There's several biblical references in this particular song, but it's it gives you goosebumps. And I'm anxious. I have not seen them perform this live. I just haven't been at the right place at the right time, but hopefully next year I'll see them perform this.
All right, well, you have another a cappella group for us next. This is Straight No Chaser with The 12 Days of Christmas.
In a pear tree. On the ninth day of Christmas, on my true love gave to me. Christmas, my true love gave to me. Eight ladies dancing, seven ladies dancing, six ladies dancing, five. You better not shout, you better not cry, you better not in a pear tree on the ninth.
No.
On the eighth, on the seventh day of Christmas, my true love gave to me. Seven swans are swimming, six geese are laying, five golden rings. Four calling birds, three French hens, two turtle doves. Here we come, the boar's head in hand, there I be decked with bass and partridge in a pear tree.
By the way, this performance has gone viral on YouTube.
It was the most viewed video for the entire year of 2007 on YouTube. And it was at that point that Atlantic Records chairman Craig Coleman happened. Somebody told him about the video. He watched it. We got to find these guys. They had all been at Indiana University as students and had done a DVD recording of this song like back in 1998, 99, somewhere in there. And they got back together for just what they thought was going to be a performance. It led to a recording contract.
You know, this is the song that I will just hum in the car, and I can never remember all the numbers. Is it Seven Swans is Swimming?
Yeah, something
six geese
like that.
A-ling. Right, yeah, it's always hard. But what about Straight No Chaser? What should we know about them?
The neat thing is they've done some recordings with Jason Mraz and Paul McCartney, Kobe Calais, and others. They're an interesting group. I know not much more about them, but it's just the music, once again, is just terrific, and it's different.
All right, well, now let's go back to some of the favorites that I heard you play on the radio back when I was a kid, starting with White Christmas. This is from Bing Crosby.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know. Where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow.
Now, this was performed by Bing Crosby in 1941. How did this song stay so successful and so popular over the years?
Well, first of all, you know, they recorded this song in like 18 minutes time, and that was it.
Wow.
Now, the version we're listening to there is not the original version, and magnetic tape was so expensive in those days that I think when they recorded this, they only made one recording of it. And they kept using it and using it and using it. And by 1946, the tape was virtually worn out. So the version that we hear is from 1947. But it puts a smile on your face.
Well, and according to the Guinness Book of World Records, this version of White Christmas has sold more than 100 million copies worldwide.
And amazing. It's the biggest selling song of all time on the face of this earth.
You think Bing Crosby knew that he was going to be like the Christmas artist? Him and Nat King Cole, I feel like.
No, you know, and he was very humble about this whole thing. He said anybody could have done it. He just happened to be at the right place at the right time.
All right, well, the last one that we have time for right now is one of my favorites. This is from the 1960s. This is The Bell That Couldn't Jingle by Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass.
A Christmas bell was crying, then Santa heard it say, I just can't seem to jingle, and I can't go on the sleigh. Then Santa soon discovered the reason.
that it cried, the bell that could have jingled, yet nothing there inside. Then Santa said, Jack Frost will bring my Christmas gift to you, and on Christmas Eve you'll jingle just like you were brand new. Then Jack Frost froze a teardrop, so each time that it swayed, the bell that could have jingled, it went jingling all the way.
I get chills, Michael.
You know what? I do too. And you know what? I remember the very first time I heard this song. We had just moved to Southern California, and I was driving into work 11 o'clock on a Sunday night. I had Pete Smith on, who was a terrific disc jockey on KMPC in Los Angeles for years. And I heard him play this song, and I had the same goosebumps the very first time, and I get goosebumps every time I hear this song. In fact, I play it almost every day between Thanksgiving and Christmas. It is a fabulous song.
Do you think that as a DJ playing these kinds of songs around this time of year, that you're in part responsible for whether people are in the Christmas spirit or not?
I would like to take a little credit for it. But, you know, what's interesting is radio 40 years ago didn't really play Christmas music until the day of. Now we have radio stations in this country to start playing all Christmas music the first week of November.
Yeah, well, you get sick of it after a while, and which is why we are talking to you today and not on Christmas Day, when I feel like by the afternoon people are done with the Christmas music. That's Mike Hale, who is also known as Mike in the Morning, my childhood DJ. He's general manager at WHMS in Champaign, Illinois. Always great to have you, Mike. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was jingling all the way.
Today, the U.S. State Department formally recognized the winner of the disputed Honduran election, sitting President Juan Orlando Hernandez, despite calls for a new election from independent observers like the Organization of American States, the OAS, and from the opposition Alliance Party, whose candidate Salvador Nasralla lost after a strange night of vote counting. Weeks of protests followed, including more than two dozen supporters of the opposition being killed. The opposition also includes left-leaning former President José Manuel Zelaya, who was deposed in a 2009 coup. President Hernandez has been implicated in corruption scandals and tied to drug trafficking. He's also accused of changing the Constitution to allow his run for a second term. Well, Gerardo Torres Zelaya, no relation to the former president, is coordinator of the Opposition Alliance, but he's in Washington to meet with the OAS and elected officials. He joins us from the NPR studios there. Gerardo, welcome.
Thank you for the invitation.
All week, we've been getting missives from the Trump administration and the State Department in different ways accepting the outcome of this election. This is the first formal recognition of the sitting president, Hernandez, as winner. Your thoughts when you heard that?
We were expecting it. We talked with people from the OAS and also from people from the State Department, and we saw that they had very different positions about Honduras. The State Department, even though of all the proof of fraud and manipulation of the elections, was willing to recognize Hernandez because they called him an ally of the United States. And he really is not. He's an ally of some of the military of the United States in the region in Honduras.
I'm just going to jump in to say that it's not just the Trump administration. The Obama administration as well supported Hernandez because there is a military base there, a U.S. military base there, and because he was said to be fighting a crime and against illegal immigration, which was particularly important to the Trump administration. Your response to that?
Well, Hernandez's government is an heir of the coup d'etat of 2009 that brought more militarization, more control over Honduran society, but also more violence and corruption and open doors for drug dealers.
Talk about that election night. It's widely thought that Hernandez's government interfered with the election. What was that like for you to watch as your candidate was 5 percentage points ahead? All the election officials felt there was no way that Hernandez could come from behind to defeat that. And then suddenly the counting stopped and he wins.
We have always known that this is a dictatorship disguised as a democratic government. And we also knew that they weren't willing to compete in a democratic election, but they were doing it because of international pressure. So when we saw that they didn't want to give the reports at 7 p.m. or at 9 p.m. or at 11 p.m., we knew that we were winning. So people went out to the streets and celebrate. The next day, when the system came down and it came back again, all the data before was erased, and now Hernandez was ahead of Narrala. Mm. So people went to the streets, and I'm talking about November 29 until this moment, and we haven't stopped fighting, defending our right to participate in democracy in a fair condition. And what the State Department is doing by recognizing Hernandez is just increasing confrontation, because the only way they can stay in power is by the use of the military force.
Look, as we said, the Trump administration also thinks they have a partner in Hernandez, President Hernandez, in the fight against illegal immigration. But other observers think that he's the cause of many Hondurans fleeing. Do you think more Hondurans will leave now because of his win?
Of course. We have only during Hernandez's government more than 30,000 underage that have come to the United States in illegal migration. It's less dangerous to cross Mexico and to cross Guatemala and to cross the border for a 10-year-old than to live in Chamelecon or to live in San Pedro Sula or to live in Tegucigalpa. The United States presents Hernandez as their ally, but they prefer to support a criminal government instead of allowing an alliance that has Nasrallah, who's from center-right, but also has people of the Libre Party that are known to be from the left and to be socialist.
Look, I want you to describe one moment. You said people aren't going to stay home. They're going to be out in the streets. But there was one day when they had to stay home because there was a curfew imposed. And so we understand they were banging on pots in their homes, and you could hear it all over the city?
You could hear it all over the cities and all over Honduras. People didn't obey the curfew. They started banging their pans. And then 3 days after the government had announced a 10-day curfew, they had to take it away because people weren't respecting it. And you had the military trucks in the streets, but the people were in the neighborhoods banging their pans and shouting and making a lot of noise just to make clear that they're not going to put their head down.
That's Gerardo Torres Zelaya of the Opposition Alliance in Honduras, no relation to the former president of Honduras, President Zelaya. Gerardo is in Washington to meet with officials here to share his concerns about the recent election in Honduras. Gerardo, thank you.
Thank you for the invitation.
And we will link you to this incredible YouTube video of those Honduran protesters inside their homes making this noise at hearandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.